So welcome to this week's edition of the Excellence in Training Academy. I'm very pleased this week to have with us Paul Callan. Paul is a retired U.S. Marine Corps colonel who served for nearly 30 years at the highest levels with the Marine Corps, a combat veteran with experience in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Paul's personal decorations include the Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, and the Meritorious Service Medal. Paul has experience in the military as a commanding officer and a chief of staff, and in the corporate sector as a chief operating officer and executive vice president. Paul has extensive experience leading people and transforming organizations into champions and models of excellence. He has a proven background in strategic planning, executive coaching, and leadership development. Paul has a Bachelor of Arts degree from Colgate University and graduated summa cum laude from the Naval War College with a Master of Arts in National Security and Strategic Studies. As the creator of the Callan Course on Leadership, Paul works with other leaders and organizations to develop a paradigm of heroic leadership and a vital reawakening of classic leadership wisdom, artfully reoriented into today's modern challenges and cutting-edge business practices. Devoted to self-leadership, self-mastery, and life cycle leadership development, Paul helps people become better equipped to assume the mantle of leadership and become the next greatest generation. So, Paul, welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy.
Brian, it's my privilege and pleasure to be with you today.
It's an honor for me to have you here. I've listened to three of the interviews that you did, the podcast that you did with Richard Ryerson on Dose of Leadership, and I was so impressed by the information that you had. I've listened to them multiple times and gone back and listened and taken a bunch of notes from them. And I really love the way that you talk about leadership and about heroic leadership. But maybe what we can do is start by maybe you defining or providing the listeners with a definition, your definition of what is a hero.
Absolutely. I choose to define a hero through what I call a classic lens, Brian, which if we go back and we look at how all societies have tried to describe the movement, the individual movement, really the collective movement towards excellence, they've always told the story, if you will, of what I call an advance, retreat, advance model, which suggests that in order for us to move towards our highest self, we have to go through what we might refer to as a spiral development, which is going to be, in some cases, periods of successes, but often periods of tests and trials and challenges. And it's through those tests and challenges, the crucible, if you will, of life, that actually calls forth and evokes our highest nature. A classic hero was always somebody who left home, went through that period of crucible, and gained something, gained knowledge, gained wisdom, you know, gained some advantage. And that person was only called a hero if they took that and then they went back and they went back to help others. They went back to help their group or society. And I think that's such a vital understanding for us to reawaken in our society, because oftentimes today we've lost sense of what a true hero is. We tend to focus instead on celebrities and what I call peripheral excellence, what you might call secondary excellence, fame, fortune, rank, position, and things of that nature, which what we know classically, what a hero always espoused, always grew into, is what we might call primary excellence or primary greatness, which is always founded on character, virtue, right, and those timeless truths that were transcendent, right, and always were elevating to the group.
Excellent. And I love when you talk about the fact that it's not only going through that crucible, gaining that knowledge, gaining that wisdom, gaining that experience, but the true hero went back to help others and share what they've learned. And I think that's a big piece that we're missing. We still are hung up in this knowledge is power, as opposed to understanding that knowledge is potential to empower others, but it's of little value if we're not sharing it. So great definition. So can you talk a little bit then about heroic leadership and some of the things that you teach around this concept of heroic leadership? And I know you teach programs on heroic leadership for the millennial generation. So can you talk about some of the key elements of heroic leadership?
Absolutely. Where we always start, Brian, is with this fundamental position, is that Great leadership is based on self-leadership, the ability to develop over time that trustworthy internal compass, that true north sense that the only way we can positively exert external influence on others is by being rightfully aligned, integrated ourselves. So we begin our definition and our training in terms of heroic leadership exclusively on what a leader is, the leader's mindset, the leader's paradigm, the lens through which a leader must view him or herself and view the world. It's interesting, we don't move into what a leader does until we reach the second phase of our program. And we think that's so vital because we believe that one of the failures of the modern style of teaching leadership is, one, is that we tend to confuse management and leadership, and number two is we rush right into what a leader does before we ever center the leader in terms of that trustworthy fulcrum of excellence, that grounding that is so necessary to have before we exert influence on others. So what we do in our program is we first reawaken the lens, what I call the paradigm of heroic leadership. And it's not an action, right? It's sight. It's seeing and hearing in a way that we can then translate the information we're seeking towards truth. So what we focus on are what we might call the core elements of a heroic lens or a heroic paradigm. And there are things like this, again, that the essence of great leadership is self-leadership. Self-leadership is built on self-mastery, right? That leadership is a way of life. It's not a tactic. It's not a situational application. It's a way of life. I often use the analogy or the metaphor of my suit jacket when I talk. I say, understood correctly, the suit jacket, which represents leadership, is us. It represents our character and the way we live our life. And the jacket never comes off. If we make the mistake of thinking of leadership situationally, we think of the jacket as going on at 8 and coming off at 4 p.m. when we leave the office, right? So leadership is a way of life. Next, that great and heroic leaders learn to develop a bias for action, right action. See something that needs to be done, act on it. Right, not based on the magnitude of the challenge or the gravity of the challenge, but based on the necessity of the action. And then finally, is that great leadership is based on the quality of response, even in the smallest things. I use this image that I call the parable of unvisited graves. And what, let me just explain what I mean by that, which gets at this point about the quality of response, is if we went into any one of our great cities in America, and I'll just pick my hometown, Boston, right? We have a tendency to think that what has now manifested itself as a great city was built by one or two iconic people, right? The reality is when I walk the streets of Boston, I realize that the city that now has blossomed was built by thousands of people who led small, who did the things that were necessary to be done in the moment, regardless of the magnitude of those, and they did them well, and they now lie in unvisited graves. And what I mean by that, there's no parades for them, there's been no holidays named after them, but what they did is they acted on the leadership requirement in the moment, and they did their duty. And that's such a vital thing for young and emerging leaders to recognize today. It's not about someday leadership. It's not about the gravity and the magnitude of the challenge. It's the quality of the response in the moment at whatever is laid at your hands and feet to do.
And that's a powerful example of, as you say, the parable of the unvisited graves. And I like it when you say thousands of people who led small, because I think, as you say, we often think of leadership in big things and those big moments and the big events and the parades, and we miss all of the small acts of leadership on a day-to-day basis. And as you say, you're always on. It's a way of life. Now, you talk about developing a bias for right action. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by right action?
Yeah, and I think that And I think you'd probably agree, and the audience would probably agree, is that one of the things that has happened slowly in our society is we've moved increasingly away from what you might call a strong language of leadership, a strong moral vocabulary. In other words, just the willingness and the ability to differentiate between true and false, you know, right and wrong. And that what you might call moral judgment is actually a signpost of an excellent society and excellent leadership. And we've kind of moved into what I'm going to call euphemistic vocabulary. Everything's a mistake and everything is relative. And so what I mean by right action is remembering that at the heart of great leadership is the ability to see truth. What is true? And then having the moral courage, what I call the cardinal virtue, moral courage, to see truth, to speak truth to power, and then to take right action, to do whatever is necessary to honor that truth, right? Oftentimes what we see modeled to us in the broader arc of our society is people being willing to abandon honor for glory, right? Not taking the right action, not seeing what was true, but doing what was convenient. So what we're trying to do is teach people that we will ultimately succeed in leadership only if we can link contemplation, in other words, the willingness to contemplate our own development and our own character evolution with action, right? We have to constantly combine those two ingredients, the ability to reflect and contemplate on our own character in our own lens so that we see truth and what needs to be done, and then tie it to action. The sight without action is folly. Right? The action without reflection, right, is often a miserable outcome. So it's important to link those two things. So by right action, what we're trying to get at is the development of moral courage to see truth and then to stand against the prevailing winds and do what is right and what you're called to do.
Excellent. And again, it's that concept of understanding, and I think this is the piece that a lot of people might miss, is that doing what's right is not always what's popular, it's not always what's expedient, it's not always what's easy, but it's always what's right. And as you said, people have abandoned honor for glory, and too often we take the easy route and do what's popular, what's expedient, what's easy, rather than taking right action, as you talk about, and doing what's right. And that's important, that contemplation with action, tying those two together and the powerful link between them. So what are some of the other elements of the heroic leadership program that you teach and the concepts that you teach?
We've moved recently, and this is a major part of the development and evolution of our course. And I'll describe it in terms of the way we discovered it. We've moved now, Brian, to a core foundational model that we call the perennial cycles of life and leadership. And let me tell you quickly how I discovered that and why I think it's so powerful is, as we evolved our course and we taught leadership as this journey, in other words, as this movement constantly towards higher stages and states of development. In other words, what we know about leadership, leadership is a master craft, right? It's the highest form of life and how we engage life. And we know it's not lineal. We know there's no direct line approach, and we know we can't reduce it to tricks and menus and gimmicks and anything that suggests a literal memorizing of traits and principles. So we've known that, and we've taught that in our program now for several years. In other words, the harder truth about leadership is that it's a journey and it takes time and it's fundamentally an evolutionary process. But what was interesting is I looked and our team looked at what we were teaching. We started to see a common thread in everything we were teaching, which was everything evolves in leadership and life through what I call spirals, right? A cyclical development, a spiral development. So one of the core components of what we teach now is we've identified these six, what we call perennial cycles of life and leadership. For example, the cycle of life, how we move, if you will, from a developing stage, right, where we get and seem to be something, into a generating stage, a generative stage, where we get into intrinsic significance, where now we're focusing on giving and being something that matters. We've developed another one, what we call the cycle of wisdom. You know, what is wisdom? We never talk about that in our modern society anymore. How does a leader understand what wisdom really is and the conversion points that are built into it and move towards increasing levels of wisdom? There's another one we built we call the habit cycle. You know, excellence is a habit. How can we teach young leaders to understand the need for what we call perfect practice, to develop those DNA-level habits that increasingly move us from success to significance and develop that deep DNA-level virtue and character that's going to let us resonate with larger and more diverse groups of people? We've created a leader cycle. How do we move from a state of initiation to transformation and then finally into regeneration? How do we regenerate our excellence? Same thing is true in our organizations. How do we move our organizations from a state of development built around ethos, and then how do we sustain that and then develop succession planning and development? So again, we go from excellence into regenerative states. So those perennial cycles now are the core organizing fulcrums of our program, to which we now tie some number of what you might call very targeted modules. But what we think is very powerful about this is it realigns, in other words, it rebalances people. We take all of those classic timeless truths that will always be true in the human dimension of leadership. We reorient them to our modern world and our modern challenges. We don't say let's go back in time. We say let's take the excellence of the past and pull it forward into our modern context. And what we think we're giving students, what we know we're giving students, because they're telling us for the first time they're being given a trustworthy fulcrum that they can ground themselves on, that they can stand on and take on these turbulent headwinds that they face in terms of the modern challenges, because it's a trustworthy place to stand. You know, it grounds them in something that they can be confident in, and they can see the actual excellence that is called forth from them based on these perennial cycles.
Excellent. And it's so true that these are classic timeless truths, but very often we're trying to reinvent things rather than going back and understanding and developing that understanding of those classic timeless truths, and then determining and teaching people how do we apply those to our modern world and the challenges that are facing us. So I love the way that you tie in those classic elements and teach it in a format and in a system and ground people, give them that fulcrum that they can stand on in today's world. Now, you talked in there about the habit cycle and that excellence is a habit. You talked about moving from success to significance. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely, and it's a great, and I think it's a very penetrating way to think about what distinguishes average from great, or what distinguishes personal success from enduring excellence. I like to use, in all the things we talk about when we get at this distinction, I like to use the image of a clock, right? Success is moving from 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock. It's important, but it's not fully sufficient. And what I mean by that is success gets us to a point of excellence in the moment or in the current time. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't set the conditions for regeneration. How do we replicate excellence year to year? And how do we pass knowledge and excellence from generation to generation? In other words, the question is, how do we now move from 9 o'clock back to 12? That quadrant is what I call the regeneration quadrant. That's the difference between success and significance. A successful leader is someone who does something in the moment and does something that's required. So we are admitting that that's important. The significant leader is the person who sets the conditions for excellence to continue after he or she has gone. How do they create regeneration so that the leaders that come behind them not only benefit from the presence of the leader, but they're actually equipped and armed to take the organization or the unit forward in time and actually to a necessary forward future end state? So we spend a lot of time talking about the attributes of significance. I like to think of it like the echo or the footprints that the leader leaves. The ultimate litmus test of a leader, in my mind, is significance, and it's answered by this question: in what state is the organization once the leader has physically left? And how do we understand that, and what are the attributes of significance so that we can build those in to the fabric of our organization so that succession and mentoring are seen as vital and cardinal and absolute core expectations of every leader in the organization, what I call building a culture of leadership, leaders developing other leaders.
Excellent. And I think, again, that's a piece that sometimes leaders fail to grasp, is that that regeneration that you talk about passing on the knowledge and setting the conditions for excellence to continue when the leader leaves. I think that that's a sign of a truly great leader, is that the success and the excellence continues once they're gone. And I assume that in order for leaders to buy into that, they need to have that dedication to something greater than themselves, as you talked about, the noble purpose, the honorable aspirations, again, those classic elements to understand that it's not about them as the leader. It's about serving the people that they have the privilege of leading. Is that accurate, or...?
It's absolutely accurate, and it again, this is gets at, you know, what's our aim point. If our organizations are built for what I call just the bottom line, right? Revenue, profit, market share, and things like that, what we're going to do is we're going to set ourselves up for what you might call a singular success. You might reach bottom line measures and metrics over a short period of time with that kind of a bottom line focus. But what we know when we go back and we honestly study the difference between good to great, The core element in my mind is the sacredness of an enduring ethos. In other words, we know people are going to leave. We know that generations are going to pass. We know that techniques and processes and procedures are going to change. But what guides us through that change, and what keeps us in accord, I think that's a key word, what keeps the organization in full accord is the sacredness of an ethos that unifies everybody. And so what's crucial is, in order for us to move in a position where we honor and we consider sacred the top line characteristics of a company, which are not material, right? They're the human dimension qualities, the character, the virtue, the principles in which we operate. They must be seen by the leader. They must be seen by the organization. And I'm using this word very specifically, Brian. They must be seen as sacred. They're non-negotiable, and they're not allowed to be violated, because they are the glue that binds us. They are the fabric that will unify us and continue to regenerate that excellence.
And so what are some of those sacred elements? You touched on a couple. What, can you talk a little bit more about some of those key pieces there?
Absolutely. And for our audience, an ethos, if you're not familiar with it, is the absolutely correct term to use when we understand what is the let's think of the term of a root system of the organization. It's perennial knowledge. It is the communal base of the organization. It answers these questions that are, in a sense, unchanging. Who are we? What do we do? Right? And why does it matter? Like, in, say, in terms of law enforcement, it's protect and to serve, right? It's those things that are unchanging that would be common reference points between every generation of law enforcement official that ever served. How they're applied changes over time, but as core foundational knowledge, they're unchanging. So what we want to understand, the sacred nature of an organization, are those root system elements that are so critical to the core character of the organization that they must be protected and revered so that we don't fall into tribal behavior, so we don't fall into factionalism. That's what happens if you go into any organization and you see them in a state of disarray, disrepair. I guarantee you in every case, the rot is coming from an unhealthy ethos. Somehow the ethos has been allowed to atrophy. In other words, what ethos does is it pulls us out of our heads and into our hearts. It gets us all collectively to focus on that thing that is greater than ourselves, something to which we collectively aspire that pulls us into a state of excellence. Right? And so it's vital for leaders to understand it is a leader's obligation not only to create it, but more importantly, to recreate it. Excellence is often a case of renovation, not creation. And we must constantly go back to our ethos when we find ourselves in disrepair and we find ourselves falling into that state of factionalism and tribal behavior and go back to our ethos and understand how we can renovate and regenerate our ethos, because it's only ethos that will bind us and pull us towards unified action.
Excellent. And that's, I think we see a lot of that where you, like you say, that tribal behavior, that fractionalization, the silos in organizations, it's huge in certainly in law enforcement, I think probably in every organization. And then it starts to break down where we're not communicating with each other, we're not sharing that common vision, that common goal, that we're not celebrating and holding sacred those core ethos and elements that you talk about. And I know I've heard you say in some of your other interviews that our minds are drawn to reason, but our souls are drawn to meaning. And so I think this ties in with that, people understanding the meaning and answering those key questions that you talked about who are we, what do we do, and why does it matter?
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's so true. Words don't convert us. Right? Words don't convert us. Experiences do. Images, it's the poetry. Leadership's poetry. Life is poetry. What pulls us into majestic performance, into excellence, is something that touches us beyond what you would call the logic of our brain. Something has to resonate with us in our souls. At our DNA level, I really believe this, regardless of generation, we all have a deep intrinsic desire to move towards excellence, to be, again, pulled into meaning, to be pulled into peak experiences. Things that actually convert us are those experiences where somebody sets an azimuth, somebody sets a future vision that pulls us out of our private worlds, our limiting private worlds, our selfish behaviors, and presents to us an image, a vision of a place up on the hill, if you will, that we can go together, that we can sacrifice together. I say this to one of my friends and partners in the program, Richie Coleman, all the time. I say, I think there's two things and only two things in life that convert us, that move us towards that state of excellence. One is deep love, and I'm using love in a classic sense. I'm talking like deep companionship, right? Deep bonding, soulful bonding, or common sacrifice. Think of that. Deep love, deep companionship, and common sacrifice. Those are the only things that convert us and move us out of our selfish prism into a collective, unified, and majestic purpose. And so what leaders must understand is that is a critical alchemy to understand. It is leaders who must create the vision and the picture of who we are, why we exist, and who we can become. And with that compellence, pull people towards that higher plane.
Excellent. And that's I really love when you talk about those two things that can convert us and move us, with that deep love and that common sacrifice. And I think this is a language that we need to use more commonly in law enforcement, because we're an interesting culture. We love each other enough, we care about each other enough, that we will put our lives at risk to go and help another officer, to rescue another officer, to back another officer up. But sometimes we won't do those day-to-day courageous things, have those courageous conversations when we see an officer's behavior taking them down the wrong path, or step up and lead when it's critical, or take that right action when you know that there's going to be perhaps some consequences or some pushback. So I think that we have, especially in law enforcement, we have that deep love, we have that common sacrifice, But we don't talk about that. We don't use that language. And so I think that, as you said, it's the leader needs to create that vision, that place where we can go together so that we help people understand who we are and where we can go together as a group. And so powerful message. What are some of the other key elements of your program or things for to help millennials become heroic leaders?
Yeah, I mean, just if you just think of the organizational structure of the course, which we think is, you know, is really powerful, is what we do. And of course, we tailor and customize. I think, like a lot of people do, we recognize the need to orient the core curriculum we have is principle based, and again, it's this deep experiential learning. In other words, we immerse students in the experience of leaders. I actually built the whole program with our team around the questions, not the answers. That sounds like a trivial distinction, but it's huge. In other words, we took leadership across the full spectrum, if you will, from the art of leadership to science, and we took all of the foundational elements of excellence, but we approached them from the standpoint of the question, not the answer. In other words, I'll give you one example, just one. Not what makes a great leader. We took it on from the standpoint of this question: why would somebody choose to follow? And the distinction there, Brian, is that when we approach leadership from the answers, we have a tendency to despiritualize leadership, right? We reduce it down to this list of kind of tricks and gimmicks and checklists, the six secrets of that, the four, you know, traits of this. As if we could give a person that list and they could memorize it and then they could internalize it. We know that doesn't happen. However, when we approach leadership from the standpoint of the question and we invite the student into that question, in other words, the experience of what it's like to generate the environment where somebody would willingly choose to follow you, what we do is we force them to wrestle with that truth. Right, we force them to wrestle with the mystery of how that alchemy happens. How does somebody move from being a subordinate to a follower and ultimately themselves to a leader? Would they align towards the leader and towards that common purpose? And by wrestling with that truth over time, it's the only way that they can internalize it. It's the only way they can appropriate that truth and make it their own. So we built our whole course around a full spectrum of learning, leadership to management, right? Very immersive, no PowerPoints. It's all imagery. It's high-powered imagery. It's stories and examples. But what we do is we pull the students into that and we force them to wrestle with it with the understanding that it's the only way through that experience that they'll be able to appropriate the truth and they'll be able to understand the maxim that's behind the principle.
Excellent. And I completely agree on the power of questions, and especially great questions, because profound questions are going to lead to profound discoveries, profound answers. It's going to enhance the learning, the growth of people. So there's when we have great questions, and as you talked about, that subtle shift in some of the language, the wording of the questions can create a tremendous learning experience and that experiential opportunity for people, as you talk about. Now, one of the things that I've heard you talk about, both of us have heard people around North America bash the new generation. We label them highly inappropriately as selfish and entitled. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I've heard you talk about, provide a great explanation as to why we have these gaps or these misperceptions between generations, and talk about some of the great things with the millennials that you are working with to help them to become heroic leaders.
Yes. I think this is such a vital thing for us to talk about, Brian, and to keep talking about, because there's so much misunderstanding and I call it, you know, urban mythology that's built up. So let me put out some I think crucial definitional points first, and then I'll give you my philosophy. And I'll do this quickly. But first of all, I think what we and I think you and I do understand, and I think the audience needs to do, is that every emerging generation throughout time has always been labeled with characteristics that go like this: adrift, lacking confidence, lacking discipline, don't care, and are self-absorbed. Right? My generation, the generation before me, was always in which is natural. Why? Because they're young, they're adolescent, and that's the nature of adolescence, right? So I think we have to start by saying every generation that is emerging has always been criticized by that generation before them. And I've found factual proof of that. I actually did this, I think, on one of Rich Ryerson's podcasts. I went back and I found quotes going back all the way to the early 1800s in America where the older generation was criticizing the younger generation, even though they used slightly different language. Again, it was the same common description: adrift, undisciplined, don't care about anybody other than themselves, and they're going to ruin our society. So once we set that aside and say that happens, why? Because they're adolescent and they're emerging, right? So here's what is different, though. Every generation has what I call a dominant social energy. For example, okay, I was born in 1959, so I'm a child of the 60s and the 70s. We had the German word is Zeitgeist. It's a common, what you might call, social energy that defines the time. It's not the people. It's just think of it like the atmosphere of the culture. When I think back to my adolescent periods, how was it defined? What was that common energy? It was kind of the beginning of the counterculture movement, right? Don't trust institutions, free love, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, grow your hair long, throw away convention, right? And it felt good when we were young, right?
Right.
But so that was kind of the defining energy of our time, right? Now, most of us grew out of that. In other words, we enjoyed it when we were young, but we grew out of it. And the question is why? Because we had wise elders and wise institutions that helped us emerge from that somewhat limiting view on life and pulled us into something that was more wise, right? So it's always been the role of wise elders and responsible institutions to guide the ascent of the emerging generation, to get them to move again out of a state of irresponsible adolescence into accountable and a responsible adulthood. Think of it like a necessary rite of passage. It's crucial in any healthy society or organization. So the listeners are going to say, okay, tracking, Paul, right? I get what you're saying, but what's different about the millennials? And there are some things that are different, right? First of all, let's just say this. Our society right now, think of it like a pendulum, Brian, and I really know this and believe this is happening. We always are moving across, again, a continuum from ideally and classically there are what you might call the definitions of optimum, you know, social performance, right? Classic true north elements of our society. And I'll throw out a couple and I'll juxtapose them to where I think the pendulum has swung in terms of modern society, not millennials. I'm talking about the fabric in which they live. And I'll just juxtapose a few. Like, for example, classically, right, we have what we would call, we should have high social trust in our institutions. Why? Because they're virtuous and they're good. Today, I think we have increasingly lower social trust in institutions. Right, we don't trust government. We don't trust educational institutions. We don't trust law enforcement. We don't trust, you know, other governmental things. In the past, we used to revere and respect self-respect, right, as a valued outcome. Today, it's self-esteem. It's a completely different thing that we prize, right? We used to believe that life evokes our character. Today we think we create self-actualization, right? Before, virtues matter. Today, utility matters. Give me something quick, fast, and immediate. So there's this society, our pendulum has swung, if you will, out into what I call episodic living, right? Where what we know excellence comes from is true north, a more heroic ambition. So think of that as the broader conditions into which the millennials were born. They didn't create it, and it's not their fault. In a sense, we handed that to them. Now, what is different about them? What's different about them is their technological lens. Their energy is tech energy. It doesn't mean it's bad, but that's their zeitgeist. So how does that inform their view of the world that they were born into? It means that they see everything through the lens of instant gratification because that's been their life. They push a button and they get it, right? It creates what I call an on-demand world. And they believe that everything should evolve that way. And what they're going to have to learn is, though, things that are in the realm of efficiency can be on demand and can be instantly gratified. Everything that has to do with human development and human excellence will always defy instant gratification, right? It will not happen on demand, right? And interestingly, of all generational groups, they have been the most peer influenced of all generations. In other words, they stay linked to their peers as their primary influence longer than any generation has. So those are the only unique facts that I can discern about the millennials. It doesn't make them good or bad or less. It just means that's the energy and the lens into which they have been introduced to the world. So it then presents to us this crucial question: how can we take that DNA level excellence that they have? In other words, they have every bit of the potential to be the next great generation that any preceding generation has ever had. The thing that they need from us is the hand that reaches across and helps guide their ascent out of that private prism into this broader view of excellence and this broader view of history and what I call the grand parade of time, so they can see where they take their excellence and where they fit in this broader arc of experience. How do we pull them to meaning and purpose? How do we get them to understand what this deep bonding is in this transcendent experience? That's our role, is to guide them. So they have all of the capability to be great. They will be the next great generation. It's up to us to help them to find the path.
Excellent. And I love the way that you explain that. And it's so critical, as you say, that we guide them. And I find it so frustrating that we blame them for the environment that they grew up in. None of us told our parents how to raise us or told society what this construct was going to be that we grew up in, and yet we're blaming them. But as you said, it's not something new. It's gone on forever. I know when I started law enforcement in 1979, they were bad-mouthing us and the new generation, and we've been doing it for, as you said, hundreds or thousands of years. So what we need to do is guide them, pull them to meaning and to purpose. And I think the great thing about this generation is that they a lot of what you read is that they're the most service-oriented generation in history. They want meaning. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves. So I think when the guide appears with these classic virtues and this information and provides that path, then they're going to get on board pretty quickly with that because they want meaning. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves.
You nailed it, Brian, and I cannot tell you how strong. This is going to be it, probably an interesting observation for you to hear. Is when we first created this course, and founded on timeless and classic principles, again, oriented to the modern world, oriented towards what you, again, this primary greatness, this thing that will always be the essential determinant of excellence in human nature, right? Most of the feedback we got was that an older generation will get this. The millennials will not only not get it, they'll reject it. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our strongest audience reactions every time are millennials. Why? Because they hunger for this. In most of their experiences in school, in the community, sometimes even in the home life, they are not getting exposed to this kind of language and this kind of majestic thinking. Because again, they're bombarded by, again, this episodic nature of life, right? Where they live in the moment. Everything is what you would call present tense to them. And what we find when we engage them is you can actually physically see them awakening to this. There's an aha in the experience where they finally go, somebody has now opened me up to seeing where I fit, again, in this grand parade, and that there is meaning out there. There is this majestic purpose that I can link my technical knowledge, I can link my passion and my energy to. And it's a huge hunger for them. And it's hugely converting for them. I think for the first time they're hearing language that is reassuring. It's challenging, but it's reassuring to them that there is a place for them. There's a place for their generation that they will be called on to lead. They do not yet know the nature or the characteristic of their challenge, but it will come, and it will be up to them to rise to that. And I think for the first time, they're hearing messages that suggest that they are the next generation and that there is a place for them to coalesce their energy around. And I think it's hugely appealing to them, and they hunger for it. They hunger for it at the most basic and DNA level fabric of their existence.
Absolutely. And I think all we need to do, I think, is just go back and look at history over the last short period of time since September 11, 2001, and look at the men and women who have joined the military and served heroically in our countries since then. And a huge percentage of them have been the millennials. They've been this Generation Y, these people that have stepped up and served tour after tour, performed at heroic levels, and because they want to be part of something bigger than themselves. They want meaning. And as you said, now when somebody can bring that meaning and that majestic knowledge and those classic timeless principles, and they put it in a language that they can wrap their heads around and their hearts around, then all of a sudden now they're going to embrace that. So powerful explanation there. Any other key elements of the program that you want to talk about what's important for people to understand when we're talking about or when we're teaching or embracing heroic leadership?
I think the key thing for the audience to really remember is why invest in, leadership development? For me, I never present it and I never think about it as a tangential thing that you do. This isn't a... this is not a tactic or it's not a something you bolt on once in a while. I think the key thing that we have to make sure everybody understands is that leadership is foundational to excellence, and it always will be. Technology is never going to replace leadership as the core determinant of excellence in our organizations, no matter what technology does in terms of outsourcing and freelancing and efficiencies, right? So I think the key thing, and this is what we really anchor our course on, is to make leadership foundational to who we are. We create it as a core expertise, an ethos effect within our organizations to create a culture of leadership. There's a way to understand that. What is a culture of leadership, and how do we create a culture of leadership in our organization? And we do it by creating a life cycle of leadership for our individuals. We put them on one of these spiral development programs in which they're constantly and totally immersed in leadership, so that they see leadership as the sine non of their existence. Everything rises and falls on leadership. And we've got to get leaders and organizations to understand that it is not an abstract thing. It is not a tactical thing. It's not a transactional thing that we do once in a while. We make it the core fulcrum of our ethos and our culture. And we constantly immerse our people in a culture of leadership, leaders producing other leadership, where leadership is the prized virtue. It is the prized outcome of our organizations. So I would say that is what we do in our program. We show people the virtue and the path of how we can create this life cycle leadership within individuals, which then translates into a culture of leadership within our organization. And here's the prized payoff. It then translates into peak organizational health. We help them isolate the core that produces peak organizational health that allows them not only to be successful in the near term, but much more importantly, it allows them to have the enduring characteristics of excellence that will carry them year to year, decade to decade, and generation to generation. And there's a way to understand that, and there's a way to build that in every organization if they approach it the correct way.
Excellent. And I love what you talk about making it a culture, part of the culture, and that leadership is foundational to excellence. And that we need to see this as leadership development as an investment. And it's an investment with a huge return on investment. Too often we see this type of training and development as a line item on the budget, which is easy to
Right.
cut, but it's too critical for us to cut it. And what I see in law enforcement is that a lot of agencies have leadership courses, but they don't have a culture of leadership. They have courses, people need to take the course, tick the box off, but we don't have that common ethos, as you say, that is foundational, that is sacred within an organization. We don't have that consistent language. It's not something that we're practicing at all levels of the organization. So I think that's so critical that people understand the importance of making it part of the culture, not just another course that we're ticking off the box. And I think what you give through the Callen course and the training that you do is you give people a foundational methodology to instill that culture and make it part of the ethos of their organization so that they have that peak organizational health. So excellent. Any resources that you would we'll talk about where people can get a hold of you and your website in a moment, but just off the top of your head, any resources that you would recommend, any books that you would recommend that people read? I know you're a fan of Joseph Campbell's work. Any books or resources that you would recommend to trainers that are listening to this that they may want to go and read or investigate?
Yeah, I would, the way I try to always answer that, because obviously when I, when I honestly reflect back about the things I've read that I thought have impacted me, they're so diverse. What I would say the reason is read widely, read often, and read widely. Like, for example, this is going to probably shock a lot of people, and I say this, if I was forced to say, who are the five people you should read, one of them's Shakespeare. And people would say Shakespeare, is a leadership reflection. Who do we know that had a better insight into human nature than Shakespeare? And leadership's all about human nature. So I'm just using that to say that oftentimes we answer that by what is on the top list of the New York Times bestseller list. But I think the best way to answer it is leadership is lifelong learning, and the best thing we can do is avail ourselves to as many insights about history, about human nature, about the human dynamic, about business as we can. So read often and read widely. And the other thing that I think is important to do is in deep reading is important, right? In other words, where we go into a biography or we go into a case study and we read it deeply. And we go in, remember what I said, go into the experience and try to feel what it's like and then appropriate that, not to copy it, but to say, what's the maxim at play there? Right, I can read, for example, about Churchill and his leadership during World War II. I can't copy him. I'm not going to be confronted with the same challenges, but I can understand the alchemy that called forth his excellence. And then I can ask myself, am I putting myself in the position where I can be ready to rise to the occasion when my challenge comes? Right. So that would be the way I'd answer the readership question. The other thing that I find very impactful, and it's something we do, like in other words, I choose not because I don't think blogs are important, but I choose to write my reflections as contemplations. Because what I think is important to do as leaders is to take a question, take a maxim, and then reflect on it. What is the inherent truth in it? And then spend some time in contemplation, understanding there's a pearl of wisdom in there somewhere. And how do I get that through thoughtful reflection and through thoughtful contemplation? So I would say for our listeners is in addition to deep reading, right, deep experiential reading is also reflection. Contemplate the deep questions about leadership and struggle with them. Right? And wrestle with them so that we can then exert and find that pearl of wisdom that's buried in it.
Excellent. Some great advice, and that's tremendous advice to read often, read widely, and read deeply. So Terrific. Now, Paul, if people wanted to get a hold of you to look at having you come in to run one of your Callan courses for them, or to have you come in and do training for them on heroic leadership, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you as far as a website, email? What's the best way for them to get that information?
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Yeah, our website is extensive in the sense that it would be the single source, easy source for any of your listeners to go to, and I'll give you the URL. It's www.callancourse.com, and that's my name, Callan Course, Course, all one word, .com. So www.callancourse.com. And in our website, like most, we've organized it so that somebody could quickly go to it and just find out the answers to those key questions. Who are we? What do we do? You know, why is it effective? And what I think that hopefully what they'll be drawn to is the fact that, again, is that what we're presenting is, like you said, is not that one-off. You know, it's not that cursory look on leadership. And I'm going to tell you, it's the hardest way to approach it, but it's the deepest and most effective. It's a cohesive, integrated, you know, highly cohesive program that they could use, whether it's for, you know, young emerging leaders, middle-level leaders, senior leaders. It could be a year-long program. We've done that with several organizations where we help them build that culture of leadership. It could be targeted coaching. So but what we don't do is we never violate the tenets of our philosophy when we tailor and customize our program. So we think that cohesive nature is very important for the people that we partner with and we work. Is we don't take a little of this and a little of that. We give them what we think is that core, vital and vibrant philosophy around which they can build that organizational culture of leadership, that trustworthy fulcrum that can guide them and their people through challenges, through the next decade, through the next generation.
Excellent. And I would strongly encourage people to go to your website and to look at engaging you and your organization to help them create that culture of leadership in their organizations, and the benefits are going to be huge for that. So, Paul, I want to thank you for your time today. I know you're a very busy man, and I really appreciate you making time in your very busy schedule for this. But more importantly, I want to thank you for your service, for your decades of service in the Marine Corps. But you have continued to serve even after leaving active service with the Marine Corps. You have continued to serve our communities, our next generation, our current generation, through the leadership training that you're doing. And the work that you're doing to teach heroic leadership is so important and so powerful. And for all of your service and everything that you have done and continue to do, I would truly want to thank you for that.
And thank you, Brian, very much for that. And it's much appreciated. And likewise, thank you for what you do. Your voice and your message is crucial. And more broadly, to the men and women of law enforcement, nothing but the deepest respect and honor for what you do and what you've always done for our nation. And I mean that honestly. And I know our entire team has we've worked in the past with several PDs. We work with fire authorities and first responders, and we have nothing but the deepest gratitude and respect for what you do and continue to do for our communities.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And so to all of the members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, thank you for listening to this interview. I'd encourage you to go back to listen to it a number of times, take notes, reflect, contemplate, as Paul has challenged all of us to do, to pull out, because there's so many pearls and there's so many pearls of wisdom in this interview, and then continue to read widely, read deeply, and read often. So I would thank you for being part of the community and continue to challenge you to maintain a pursuit of excellence in and through training and always be willing to dare to be great.